If my parents ever told me about my great-great-grandfather's buried porcelain, it had never registered. Growing up in Utah, I paid little attention to family stories, most of which concerned overcoming hardships that I, preoccupied with overcoming my own hardship of being Chinese and non-Mormon in Salt Lake City, couldn't relate to and didn't care to hear about. Any reminders of my family history only impeded my goal of being as American as possible, or, short of that, as un-Chinese as possible. A rebellion that included working harder at sports than math and refusing to apply to Harvard. As far as I was concerned, the Chinese people in my life, with their loud, angry-sounding manner of speaking and odd habits, were from another planet and had traveled to Earth for the sole purpose of embarrassing me. But I always loved to dig. And as a child, I made many holes in the backyard looking for arrowheads or fossils, usually giving up once I hit a thick layer of clay a few feet down, which was about the same time my mother noticed what I was doing to her lawn anyway. As I got older, this preoccupation manifested itself in searching for things thought lost, non-existent, or impossible to find. I spent most of my time in an MFA program ignoring my classmates' suggestions to write about being Chinese, instead researching the unique discovery of an antibiotic during World War II. It was isolated in the tissue of a little girl who had been hit by a car, and trying to track down that girl. As a journalist, some of my favorite stories also involved hunting, looking for edible mushrooms in city parks, poking around the storerooms of Washington, D.C. institutions for forgotten art, stalking pickpockets with undercover police, and profiling an obsessive amateur archaeologist cataloging the Paleo-Indian history of his neighborhood, with whom I participated in a number of surreptitious excavations, satisfying an old itch. After taking a job at the Seattle Weekly, I visited the Seattle Art Museum for a story and found myself drawn to Sam's Chinese porcelain collection. My parents never owned any such porcelain, and my encounters with it were limited to mentions of Ming vases, always pronounced vase, as signifiers of wealth in pop culture. But perhaps because I had just moved to my fourth city in 7 years, the collection elicited some subconscious familiarity with it. My favorite object was a little red chrysanthemum dish, about 6 inches in diameter, with scalloped edges that caught the light in a way that rendered them almost translucent. Decorated with a square of 64 gold Chinese characters, all the Sam curators could tell me was that it had been fired sometime in the late 18th century. Since the Sam curators had never bothered to translate the text, I called my father, a physics professor who, just for fun, once spent a sabbatical summer doing conservation work at Chicago's Field Museum. His nerdiness caused me no small amount of anguish when I was young. He wore a pocket protector well into my high school years, but he was also the exact kind of nerd who could translate the dish for me. The poem, my father told me, had been penned by the owner of the plate, the fifth emperor of the Qing dynasty, Qianlong, and was a paean to the makers and craftsmanship of the dish. And because my father is incapable of answering any question without first fully contextualizing the answer in the most pedantic way possible, he went on to explain that Qianlong was known for leaving his mark, in the form of calligraphy, stamps, and poems, on many precious pieces of art, a common practice among Chinese collectors. His calligraphy was okay, my father said, but he's not remembered as a poet. Qianlong was one of the great figures in Chinese history, both a successful military leader who expanded China's territory by millions of square miles and a devoted patron of the arts. He commissioned one of the most ambitious literary projects in Chinese history, the creation of a library of classic Chinese texts, and fancied himself a bard. During his reign, the imperial kilns in Jingdezhen, about 90 miles east of my great-great-grandfather's village and the center of world porcelain production, reached their zenith in technology and quality. But Qianlong was also famously Sinocentric, refusing to increase trade with the West, and rejecting the Industrial Revolution as a fad and Western technology as toys. At the height of Qianlong's rule, China was the richest country in the world by a wide margin. When he died in 1799, his treasury was empty, porcelain exports to Europe had all but stopped, and centuries of progress and innovation were undone, setting China on course for humiliating defeats in the Opium Wars, the Sino-Japanese Wars, massive domestic rebellions, and finally, the overthrow of the Qing dynasty and the eventual rise of communism. One more thing, my father said before we hung up. Your mother's family had some porcelain. You should ask her about it.